Chazara as well. Our policy of doing Shlishi this year, doing one Aliyah per year, has felt some interesting benefits. So this is a case in point. Parshas told us there's so much going on in terms of the Bechorah and the whole struggle between Yaakov and Esav that the third Aliyah would not get much attention. It's easy to focus on the first Aliyah, it's easy to focus on what comes later. And if one had only one topic to talk about, or only a certain limited amount of time to talk about the Parsha, they probably wouldn't get to discuss the third Aliyah too much. But the third Aliyah is a little bit, it's kind of a Hasidish Aliyah. They have an approach that the Sfarim take of interpreting a story, which it's hard to see what exactly the significance of the story is. They tend to interpret this Aliyah as having much remez and much allegory, perhaps. And when I say it's a Chassidish approach, so it's one that is certainly found in the Chassidish Svarim, and therefore perhaps a little more than usual will make reference to such Svarim. But it's also one that's found in the Ramban, basically. And that seems to be the attitude, the Dore Doris, of how to view this third Aliyah of Toldos, which essentially focuses on what seems to be a minor story, the story of Yitzchak digging wells, re-digging the wells that Avram had dug, and then digging more wells, and getting into a fight with the local shepherds who were jealous of his wealth, and who felt like he was becoming rich at their expense, which gets into the whole communism-capitalism issue, but they were upset with him, and they asked him to leave. And the Ramban asked the question what the significance of the story is. And we'll talk about in a second about the approach, the somewhat allegorical approach that even he takes and that you find in the later Sfarim for sure. So we'll spend a few minutes on this Aliyah and just highlight some of these points. And then go to Chazara. So the Aliyah begins saying, Vayigdal Ha'ish, that this man, Yitzchak, became big. So what does it mean he became big? So one might get the impression that it means he became very wealthy, which was indeed the case, and which the Aliyah goes on to talk about. That the Slonim Rebbe, one of the most popular contemporary Chassidish Svarim on Chumash, the Nesiv HaShalom, so he asserts that it can't mean that, that that would not be something the Torah would consider it to be an indication of godless, and that the only reason the Torah is talking about his wealth here, he asserts, is because it's relevant to the whole fight with the shepherds. But the godless must be a godless of spirituality, of avodas Hashem, and he goes on to interpret, again a little bit al pi derech haremez, that that's what right before this Aliyah, the end of the second Aliyah, so when it says that Yitzchak discovered Mei HaSharim, he went right past the Gula and he knew where to look, so that the Mei HaSharim represents 100 different paths to avodas Hashem. And that were it not for the challenges and the struggles that he had in his life, he wouldn't have discovered all these different paths. But because he had to deal with all these realities of existence, that was what made it possible for him to discover these new paths. And that approach, he then goes on to say, is an approach of shiflus, is an approach of modesty, and of not holding oneself up in a very arrogant fashion. And he suggests that's also what the Pasuk, when the Pasuk says he grew ma'od, so it's a reference to ma'od, ma'od, hevi shval ruach, that a person should have a lot of humility. So that's the idea here also, that Yitzchak developed a sense of humility, or he refined his sense of humility, and that he became a great Oved Hashem through his perfection of this quality, and it's through that that we get to Yerusha Sa'aretz, which is also one of the major themes that this Aliyah is indicating. And he goes on to say that that was the problem with the Meraglim. The Meraglim did not have this Midas HaShiflus. He focused on the fact that Torah describes them as Anoshim Rashi B'nai Yisrael. That's a very grandiose term. I also thought, maybe you could say, he doesn't say this, the Nesiv HaShalom, but that maybe the word Ish, in terms of Yitzchak, the whole language of Yigdal HaIsh, which is a little bit of an unusual way to describe him, maybe that's a proof to his idea that it's about his character growing, that his spirituality increased. But in any case, Ish can also be a statement of status, and perhaps on Noshim, Rashi B'nai Yisrael is a reference to the fact that the Meraglim held themselves up in a very haughty fashion, and we know the Zohar says that they were afraid that they would lose their leadership positions, and that's why they were inclined to naysay about Eretz Yisrael, and therefore it's relevant that that was what steered them away from being able to appreciate and to inherit the land. But this character of Shiflus, that's what Yitzchak represented, and that's what was able to allow his descendants to inherit the land indeed. So from that, the Torah thou tells us in Saliyah the story of the wells. And that's what prompts the Ramban to ask, what exactly is going on here? Why do we need to be told the story of the wells? What exactly is the significance that it should be in Chumash? And he suggests that it's really a remez, that it's really a way of saying that this is not something that was necessarily so significant in of itself, except for what it represents about the future. That it represents the Batei Mikdash, that it represents a time in the future when the world will be focused on God's glory, and therefore that's the imagery here. All of these wells represent the different Batei Mikdash. So the first one, he says, the Torah calls it Asek, and that refers to the fact that people were very involved with it. There were a lot of wars, a lot of attacks on the Beis HaMikdash until it was destroyed. And then the second one is even worse, Sitna, that's the name of the second well, so that refers to the attacks and the constant onslaught onto the second Beis HaMikdash until that was destroyed. And then the third Beis HaMikdash, about which the third Be'er, the Torah says, there was no fighting, there was just a Rechovos, there was just breath, that will refer to the third Beis HaMikdash, which will exist in peace, and which will, P-A-P-E-A-C-E, not in pieces, but in Shalom, and that will last without the Muhammad. So that's a reference to the third Beis HaMikdash, Los Adobo. So it's a fascinating approach. Again, this is not just in the Chassidus Sfarim, this is the Ramban saying that that's what the Pasuk is meant to, that's what the story is meant to convey. Amir?
What were the first two wells on?
Asek and Sitna. That's what the Pesukim call them. So what is the imagery of these words? So one is Asek, like they were the focus of a lot of attention, a lot of involvement, and Sitna, the Satan, is the one who accuses, the one who attacks. So again, it's an even more egregious form of being under a constant onslaught. So this is the approach the Ramban takes, and the Slonim Rebbe in his Sefer, so he goes on with the whole theme of Ramazan. You can take a look over there, where he talks about how the three wells represent the three Avos, and their qualities, or perhaps represent different stages of life. He has a whole arichus about that, but what's particularly fascinating, there's a Sefer here called Ma'oris Yitzchak, which is appropriately titled for this parsha, because it means the enlightenments that come from Yitzchak, which is basically what I'm about to refer to. But the paper is called that for other reasons than the Mechaber I'm acquainted with. His name is Yitzchak, but it happens to be that his subject for this parsha is the Ma'oris Yitzchak. So he has about 40 pages on this, which if anyone has some spare time, he goes through all of the various imageries that one could apply to the wells. And he says that if the Ramban's point is correct, that basically this is a reference to the Beis HaMikdash, Los Adobo, to the Batei HaMikdash that were still yet to come. So why is that specifically here? And why is it Davka Yitzchak who becomes the context for transmitting all of this ultimate message about the Beis HaMikdash? So he has a fascinating, lengthy discussion. Again, we can't really do justice to it in the time that we have, but I just want to call your attention to it. So one of the things he suggests is that we have an understanding that Chazal have conveyed that the key attribute of Yitzchak is the Midas Hadin, right, which we normally translate as the attribute of letter of the law judgment rather than Midas Harachim. So what does that mean to be a Midas Hadin? The Gemara says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu first wanted to create the world Midas Hadin, and then we saw that it wasn't going to last, so we created with the Midas HaRachem. So why do we have to be told, okay, this was the Havmah, this was the Maskana? So as far as I'm explaining, But it's in order to convey to us that really the Midas Adin is the way we're supposed to be. We're supposed to be able to comport with the Midas Adin. But because of human frailty, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu had to create this world with Midas HaRachamim, but we still recognize that Midas Adin is what we need to strive to adhere to. So there's a fascinating Gemara. I remember Rabbi Yisrael Blachman was fond of discussing this very striking Agadata, which is in our Masechtas and Shabbos and Daf Pei Tes. So just make quick reference to it. That the Gemara says, Amr of Shmuel ben Achmeni, this is the Gemara Pei Tes and Mekbeis and Shabbos, Amr of Yonasan, Ma'id Yechsev, Ki Ata Avinu, Ki Avram Liyadana, Yisrael Yechirenu, Ata Hashem Avinu, Gol Veinu, Be'erlam Shemecha, that Avram was not able to help us, and Yisrael, and Yaakov didn't recognize us, you're the one who saved us. What does that mean? So says the Gemara, the following story. Blessed Lavo, Yomer Lo Akadosh Baruch Hu LeAvram, Banecha Chatu, Brach Banecha Chatu. God's going to come to Avram up in Shemayim. He's going to say, "Your children have sinned." And what's Avram going to say? He's going to say, "Yomer Lo, I'm a Lofan of Ribono Shalom, Yimachol Kedusha Shemecha." Okay, they sin, they have to be destroyed. The Kiddush Hashem, that the punishment should be executed, and that's what's going to have to happen. They'll have to be destroyed. So apparently that's not the answer HaKadosh Baruch Hu was looking for. So he decided to relay to Yaakov, the Havalei Tzari Gulban. Says he'll talk instead to Yaakov, who had to deal with the challenges of raising so many children. And maybe Yaakov will have a better answer. Maybe if we speak to Yaakov, the Gemara says, Efshir Devoy Rachim Yelayim. He'll pray for them. He won't just take such an attitude, let them to be destroyed. So what happens? He speaks to Yaakov, and he says, Amr le bonecha chatu, your children have sinned. Amr le far of your bones, well, mimacho al kiddush shemecha. If that's what happens, they have to be destroyed. They have to be punished. So it's not the answer Kodesh Baruch was looking for. So he said, Amr lo besavi taima, lo bedarti ki eitza. That the grandfather of Ram, he's not giving me the good reason I'm looking for, and the grandson Yaakov, he's not giving the counsel that I'm seeking. So Amr lo Yitzchak, he says instead to Yitzchak, Bonecha chatu, your children have sinned. So what does Yitzchak respond? It doesn't say Imacho Kiddush Shemecha, but instead, first he says Yibonu Shalom, B'nei lo Bonecha, that it's me, my children, like, you know, like two spouses fighting, your son did something terrible, my son. So Yitzchak says, Banai, below Banecha, it's my sons and not your sons. The Shah Shek Dimu Bafanev Nasa Benishma, when the Jews said Nasa Benishma, and they said Nasa first, so Karasa Lahan Beni Bechari, then you refer to them as your sons. Oh, when they behave, they're your son. And when they misbehave, they're my sons, just like a husband and wife fighting. So now it's Banai Vol Banecha. That's point one. The oaths, Kamachatu. Really, how much did they actually sin? How much could they possibly have done wrong? Kamashkoso Shaladam Shiv Mashana. How long does a person live? 70 years. Dal Esrim Dal Nasha Salayu Pasha Lechamshim. So if you subtract 20 years, we say that a person is not of our own Shinshul until he's 20. So the first 20 years don't count. So he's left with 50 years. Okay, so yeah, 50 years to sin in this world. Dal Chavhei Lavasa, subtract 25 of those years, that's nighttime. So how much could they do during the nighttime? They're asleep. So then, Pashalei Chavhei, they only have 25 years in which to sin. Dal Tarte Saru Palga Ditzluye Yamechad Vesekise. Let's subtract 12 and a half of those years because they go to the bathroom and they eat and they're davening, so there's not so much time to be sinning then. So Pashalei Tarte Saru Palga. So all they have is 12 and a half years to really do anything wrong in their whole lives. Yamata Soivul is Kulam Utav. God, if you think you can handle that, good, then you take the whole thing. Yamav, Palgalai, Palgalecha. And if not, then let's split it. You take the burden for half, and I'll take the burden for half. V'yimtim t'lomar kulam alai. And if you want to say that I should handle everything. Okay, ha'kredlis nashri kamach. I was willing to sacrifice my life for you. I was offered on the mizbeach, right? Okay, this is chag, so I can handle it. So then the Gemara goes on to say that this was a successful approach. So the Jews realized that Yitzchak was the one who saved them. So what in the world is pshat in this gemara? What exactly is going on? And it's a little bit the opposite of what you might come to expect. If Yitzchak is the midas hadin person, so then he'd be the one who you'd expect to be the harshest. And here it's Davka, Avram, and Yaakov who say, well, they sinned, what are you going to do? Yimachal al Kedushamecha. And Yitzchak is the one who saves the day. So what's pshat? So Yaakov Kamenetsky, in his Emes Liakov, he suggests that all of the Avos were tested in the Midah that they were best at. They were tested to go the opposite way. So therefore, it's Davka, the Yitzchak, the Midas Adin, he's tested to come up with Rachmanis over here. So he doesn't like that the Maris Yitzchak, because first of all, the Nisyon is taking place after they're already dead. They're not responsible for anything. They're up in Shemayim, they're still being tested. It's a little hard to believe. And Yitzchak's test was the Akedah also. He was the one who brought up the Akedah. And still, how would you explain why Avram and Yaakov, who were more connected to Midas HaChesed, so they would not be able to come up with this? You need Davka Yitzchak to come up with this just because it's the opposite of his Midah. They went to him first. The Gemara doesn't say it just went to Yitzchak. So he suggests, he has a whole fast discussion, and he goes on about this for about 40 pages, different aspects of it. But he says that Midas HaDin, you have to translate it properly. It doesn't mean that you get punished. It doesn't mean that you get a harsh judgment. It doesn't mean things are bad, necessarily. It means Midas HaDin means you have to judge the way things should be, and not deviate from what should be. So Rachmanis means, okay, this guy deserves to die, but instead of killing him, we'll have Rachmanis and we'll let him live. But Din is explaining why he deserves to live. So the attribute of Yitzchak, what's he going on here? He's not saying, yes, you're right, they're guilty, but what can you do? Have Rachmanis. Because, as he goes on to explain here, this is a time loss of love, basically at the end of history, when it's a time of Din, that Kadosh Baruch Hu is going to be relating to the world with the Midas HaDin. And now Rachmanis gives you more time until you get to that point, but now it's Din. So now we really have to be able to survive on that scale. So Avraham and Yaakov, who were inclined towards Chesed, said, okay, the Chesed can't help us here because this is a time of Din. We need to have an answer based on Din. So it's Yitzchak, who is the expert of Din. Yitzchak's able to say, listen, do the math. If you look at the facts, then you see that they don't deserve to die. Not that you should have Rachmanis on them and that you should let them off the hook. But you should understand that, look, if you look at everything in such detail, there isn't so much of history of sinning. And also, the opening line says, Banai velo banecha, my son is not your son, that you recognize that they already took that extra step and accepted the Torah and Nasa ben Ishma when they didn't even ask what was in it, and you therefore took them on as sons. So it's reasonable that the king should relate to the son in a different way and shouldn't treat him like he's a nobody from outside the family. So therefore, all of this is Yitzchak using his Midas HaDin to be the salvation of Klal Yisrael and to explain how that's the way the Jews can continue to survive and to represent God's message in this world. So therefore, he goes on to suggest, there are many different versions of this, again, if anybody has the time, it's interesting reading. But he says that the notion is the Beis HaMikdash ultimately is supposed to be the revelation of God's glory in this world, Al Pi Din, not just Al Pi Rachmanis, but that the way things are meant to be, God's glory is being displayed in its full extent. So therefore, that's a message that Yitzchak is able to represent, and that loss of love, Yitzchak will be the one to uphold that message. So that's essentially what the Ramban is getting at, that this is being marumas in this aliyah, that these wells are there to represent Yitzchak's activity in this area and to represent the Batei HaMikdash, loss of love, which will go through hard times but will ultimately be enduring and peaceful, and all of that is supposed to meet that Yitzchak. It's a fascinating idea. Mary, you had a hand up?
Yeah, so Yitzchak's Midas HaDin, did he contribute to giving Esav the birthright? No, because, I feel like if it was Abraham, you would be like, well, Esav's sort of like a shady guy, you know? And,
interesting.
It doesn't really look like he's going to continue to learn
right.
the Torah.
So he doesn't feel like he has so, the discretion to.
Maybe Yitzchak was like, well, he's the firstborn.
That's the din.
That's it. So I have to give it to him and everything.
Could be.
Out.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe there is a. Maybe if I had a chance to read further, maybe he makes that point. But actually, I think I'm going to call him up and tell him how much fasting I found. We'll see if he has what to say about that. But it's an interesting point as well. So just to say one or two other points about this Aliyah, then we'll go to a little bit of Hanukkah. So the Netziv also in his commentary to this Aliyah, if you see a couple of places, he goes on also to focus on the Gullus imagery here. And so basically Yitzchak represents the fact that he's being thrown out of the area by these shepherds. It represents Gullus, and he goes on, if you look also in the commentary of Lutzker Rav, his Nayim LaTorah, he finds many imageries here of anti-Semitism and about the whole history of anti-Semitism. Look, here the Jew is able to bring great wealth to society, he's able to contribute in such positive ways, and still the population is just jealous and wants to throw him out. Everybody from the Ramban on down, everybody is interpreting this Aliyah in somewhat of an allegorical fashion. Not that the facts aren't there, but that the importance of the story is that it represents something loss of love, it represents eternal trends of anti-Semitism, of Gullus and the like. It's a constant theme, basically. Everyone who talks about this Aliyah, from the Rishonim to the Achronim to the Contemporary Sfarim, from the Misnagdim to the Hasidim, they all seem to take this approach to this Aliyah. And the Netziv says also, for example, so here you have Yitzchak is thrown out, but because he's thrown out, sitting by the rivers, he's able to see the wells and he's able to protect them. And so that's a constant theme of Gullus, that we think things are going badly for us and we don't realize that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is really putting us in a position to save us. And that's the focus and that's the function. So that's, again, part of this imagery that you find throughout this Aliyah, whether it's about the Beis HaMikdash, whether it's about different qualities of the Avos, whether it's about different stages of life, whether it's about Gullus, whether it's about anti-Semitism. There's a lot that's packed into this otherwise, apparently, relatively mundane story, as the Ramban seemed to initially understand it. And there's a lot that has been entered in and understood within the context of these psukim. So I'll just mention one last idea as kind of a synergistic segue into Hanukkah, because it's interesting, the last pasuk of this Aliyah has a remez to Hanukkah. We're not up to the parshiyos yet, where that normally is understood to be the case, the Vayeshev and Mikes, but here as well, just to kind of segue us into our Hanukkah topics. So the last pasuk of the Aliyah says that he then built, he made this final well. V'yatek mishon v'yachbor b'racheras v'loravo le v'yikra shmar rechovos v'yomer ki ata hirchiv Hashem lanu farinu v'aretz. Just before I say this, actually, the Son of Rebbe has even more imagery here. If you look at it, he talks about the whole idea of Be'er Sheva, and that he says that the Avos, the whole notion of the Avos, was that they were creating a context for Kedusha to be nourished and brought into this world. That's the whole involvement of the Avos in this world. So the Be'er that draws water out of the ground, that's really the symbolism of that. And Avram started this work, and Yitzchak continued it. And so altogether, there's seven wells, because here you have Avram made three, and then Yitzchak revived those, and then made three more, and then he made this last one. So he suggests, the Son of Rebbe, they represent the 7 days of the week, and the 7 days of accomplishment in this world, and therefore Be'er Sheva is the Shabbos well. That's a special well, that's why it gets the name, that's why it has such a significance. And it says that therefore the Be'er Sheva of Avram and the Be'er Sheva of Yitzchak are two different words, that by Yitzchak, by Avram, it's Be'er Sheva, based on Shavuah, that there was a deal that took place over there, so that's the name. But here it's Be'er Sheva, it's the seventh well, it represents the Shabbos of the wells, of this involvement in bringing Kedusha into the world. But in any event, so this last well was a good one, and the sixth well was a good one also, Rechovos. So here he says that he calls this last well V'yikra Shema Rechovos V'yomer Ki Ata Hirchiv Hashem Lanu U'farinu Ba'aretz, that God has made room for us, He has been expansive with us, and therefore we are able to be fruitful in the land. So the Baal HaTurim says that there's a remez here to a medrash about Hanukkah. And the medrash says that one of the things that happened on Hanukkah one of the gezeros that the Yavanim made is that the woman shouldn't go to the mikveh. And if a woman did go to the mikveh, so the husband, I think, would be killed. And if they saw the woman going to the mikveh, then they would take her for their own. So the women stopped going to the mikveh, and the husband stopped being with them because they weren't able to go to the mikveh. So then the Greeks had the attitude that, okay, so the women are neglected, so then we will, for all the more so, we're able to take them because they've basically been abandoned by their husbands. So then the Jews said, what are we going to do? We can't go to the mikveh because they'll kill us. We can't neglect our wives because then they'll take them anyway. So we just have to somehow bypass the requirement of mikveh, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu should have rachmanis on us and understand that there's nothing we can do. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu did a nes, and he opened up mayonos inside the houses, that all of a sudden people's floors opened up and there was a mayon inside the house, so they were able to be tovel inside the house and not have to go outside to go to the mikveh. It's a medrash, but the Baal HaTurim, we don't have a full chumash here, but the Baal HaTurim on this pasuk, he suggests that this is a remez to this, that he says, yirchivu, that we were given more space, that it was broadened, that that's the idea, that the houses opened up and there were mayonos inside, and ufarinos, so we're able to be fruitful and multiply, we're able to have children because of that, because of this nes, that that's also a future remez in this pasuk. So it's also brought in some svar, and the Tshuva Shevet HaKahasi was the Dayan in Bells, he's a Tshuvas, but he also talks about the Belzer customs. So he quotes from the Belzer Rebbe that they have a practice of putting water into the oil for the Chanukah lights, and he bases this on the idea that the Belzer Rebbe had said that Shemen is a remez to the various mitzvos that the Yevanim tried to stop us from doing, Shabbos, Mila, and Nida, Shin Mem Nun. So therefore the Shemen is used in order to evoke those mitzvos that we were able to rescue, and because there was a nes involving water, so that's what they have the meaning to add a little water into the oil. So the Baal HaTurim says that this last pasuk in the third Aliyah is a reference to the oil of Hanukkah candles. Speaking of which, so let's spend a few minutes, we probably won't get the whole topic finished, but let's spend a few minutes now chazering the topic of the Isser Lishdamish Laura. So we will try to talk in very broad terms about what exactly is the main theme there. So we know that we paskin la halacha, or we think we paskin la halacha, that it's also Lishdamish Laura, that we're not allowed to use the Hanukkah candles. What's striking is that there is an opinion in Rishonim not like that. Because one of the issues that the Rishonim struggle with, which we won't get into so much detail right now, is that on Chafalaf Mibbez, the Gemara says, also Lishtamish Laura, and that seems to be the conclusion. It's Machlokas in the Gemara, but that seems to be the winning view, that you're not allowed to use the candles. But on Chafbez Mid Aleph, there is another sugya about not counting money by the light of the Hanukkah candles. So all the Rishonim struggle to some extent with the question of what's the chiddush of that sugya. If we know already that we're not allowed to use the Hanukkah candles, so why do I have to have another sugya telling me that I can't count money by the Hanukkah candles? So the Rishonim have different answers. This isn't a real hishdamshus. This is just a light kind of usage, like in the Kal sense, not in the Or sense. So if that's the case, maybe you need a special chiddush to say that this is also prohibited. The Baal HaMor was the one who felt that this is an impossible question, and there's basically no way to reconcile the two. So therefore, you'd have to say that the conclusion is mutter lishtamish lora, that you're actually allowed to use the candles. And this is a separate issur of bizui mitzvah, acting in a disrespectful way towards the candles, that's prohibited, but other usage that's not necessarily a bizui is not prohibited. So he's the exception among the Rishonim that this is a Baal HaMor. So he's the exception among the Rishonim that he seems to maintain that we don't actually hold that it's also Lishdamish Laura. We mentioned the other day, yesterday or the day before, that there are some who interpret Rashi along those lines as well. That's a little bit of a question. They don't interpret Rashi that way. But as far as we know, in terms of explicit sources, it's really the Baal HaMor who takes this view, because he finds this question to be unresolvable. And the the other Rishonim are not that bothered by the question. They're bothered enough to answer it, but they're not bothered in the sense that they throw their hands up and say, there's no way to reconcile it. So therefore, the other Rishonim just answer the question without coming to the conclusion that you have to change the maskana, and we generally assume that it's also l'hishtam mishlorim. So the question is, so why is it also? So you have somewhere between three answers and six answers, or more. That basically, the reason I say between three and six is because we could discuss, let's say, six answers, maybe seven. We could discuss, let's say, six answers in groups of two. Each of these two answers, each of these couplets might be one reason or two, depending on how you see it. So one couplet is that Rashi here says that you're not allowed to use the candles so that it should be nicker, that they're ner mitzvah. And we focused on this during the Shamish discussion, that it's a little bit of a difficult position to understand, because how does something become nicker by you're not doing something? That normally if you want something to be visible, you'd have to do something. So in order for this to be a hecker, you'd have to be under 24-hour surveillance, that everyone's going to watch you and see that you never use the Hanukkah candles, and that will raise their curiosity, and they'll realize it must be that it's a ner mitzvah. So it's a little bit of a hard idea to understand. And we suggested at the time, and it also came up talking with the Shamish this week, that maybe since this halacha results in the innovation of the Shamish, so you have to have an extra candle there, and Rashi Taka says in that sugya that it's all about heker, nicker, 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 he says a few times. So maybe what Rashi means is that the Isser creates the need to have this visible symbol of the Shamish, and the visible symbol, that's going to be the heker. So if we force you to have another candle because Asher l'Shamish l'Ora, then it comes out that there is a visible sign that this is Ner Mitzvah. Maybe that's what Rashi's getting at. Or you could say that, and this is why it's either one reason or two reasons, so the Rush has a different formulation. The Rush says, because we don't want people saying, L'tzorcha hu da'adlik. We don't want people saying that he lit the candles so that he can use them for his own personal purposes. So that sounds like an inverse formulation of what Rashi is saying. Not so much that we need it to be affirmatively recognized, but that you can't contradict its mitzvah status. So if you're going to do something which will be perceptible as using the Ner Chanukah for your own purpose, it'll look like you're lit them for that reason, and that will negate the mitzvah status of the candles. So perhaps the Rush and Rashi are saying the same thing, perhaps they're two different things, but the Rush's formulation seems to be a little easier to relate to as far as that question mentioned a second ago. So that's one and two, or one, depending on how you want to count them. The next set of reasons that might be one or two is that you find that a number of the Rishonim, including the Balamor and the Ran and the Rashba, mention that the Neir's Chanukah were instituted to evoke the menorah of the Beis HaMikdash, and therefore the Isser Hana flows from that, flows from the fact that it's meant to be the Beis HaMikdash menorah representation. So if that's the case, it's a little bit striking that the Balamor was the one who said, this is just to fill in what we quoted from a minute ago, that he says, since that's the case, since it's Dumya the menorah of the Beis HaMikdash, then he can't understand why anyone would ever need to be told that you can't count money by it, and therefore that should be the reason for the Isser Hashtam Shishpa'ora, but we must not paskin that way because of the other sugya. And again, the other Rishonim were not so bothered. So we discussed, as Rabbi Yochum Olshan, Rashi of Lakewood, discusses his point, that he thinks that this one reason is really two, that the Ran and the Rashba have a milder version. They say that it's supposed to represent the menorah and the Beis HaMikdash, so therefore we treat it as if something that we shouldn't make usage of. But the Balamor said it in a more chomer way, that it actually has the din of the menorah in a kedusha type of sense, and therefore it's Isser Gomer to use the candles, and what he would have used for the reason if he paskin that it's Aser leads him to a more stringent understanding of the type of Isser. So that comes out saying that there's actually kedusha to it, which you have to work out with the next Gemara, because Chabez Ben Aleph actually seems to say straight out that there's no kedusha to the lights of the Hanukkah candles. But on the other hand, we do have Haneris Halalu, where we say Haneris Halalu Kodeshim, so that could possibly be a support for the idea that that's what's going on here. It's actually kedusha Kiddushin, the candles, like the menorah of the Beis HaMikdash, and that's the nature of the Yisra. So again, here you have, it looks like it's one answer, all the menorah comparisons among these Rishonim, but maybe that also breaks down into two different answers, that it's meant to represent the menorah that's actually treated, the Shvanim and the Psilos are actually treated like the Beis HaMikdash itself, like it's actually like Mi'ula to some extent to use it for anything else.
So I'm a little confused on the menorah. The second interpretation, in where we say that many Rishonim compared to the menorah in the Mikdash.
What's the difference between the two?
Not the difference, but you mentioned the Baal Menorah in his answer, and you said if you were to hold that.
Right, so he says that, it's a little confusing the way he says that the Isser is because it's like the menorah of the Beis HaMikdash. That's the explanation for why it would be Usser to use the Hanukkah candles.
But we said before.
Correct, but then he says, the halacha, we don't paskin like it.
Okay.
He says that if we were to paskin like it, it's because of that. But that's, it's all part of his position, because if that would create such an overwhelming isser, we'd have a very hard time reconciling that with the other passage. So that's what it would have been about, but because it's about that, and that's such a big deal, it's not true, halacha, and he doesn't accept it. So it must be, and that's what Revulsion emphasizes, that the Baal HaMor's version of this menorah idea is a more chomer version, a more absolute based on Mikdash kind of version than that which the Rashba and the Ran are maintaining. So that's the second set of two that might be one. The third set of two that might be one is the idea that you find some Rishonim evoking the concept of Bizui Mitzvah, which seems to be an explicit Gemara on the next element, that there is a concern of Bizui Mitzvah. So either that's a separate concern, or that's the definition of why it's usher to use the candles. But it does seem to be supported by the Gemara that there is such an issue of disrespecting the Mitzvah. And then you also find the Rishonim talking about the concept of Huktzel Mitzvaso, that when something is set aside for a mitzvah, so we consider it to be muktzah. Some Rishonim understand that in the Shabbos and Yentiv sense, that you can't use it, you can't move it on Shabbos and Yentiv. And others understand it in a sense not really about Shabbos and Yentiv, but that it's not touchable, usable, because it is dedicated for its mitzvah purpose. So those two reasons, are those the same reason, or is that one reason? So that's also a shaila. Some of the Rishonim, such as Tosfos and the Ran here, they seem to see it clearly as two reasons. Sometimes Bizui Mitzvah is relevant, and sometimes Huktzel Mitzvah is relevant. And the Ramban, in his commentary to the third parak in Daf Mem Hei, and other Rishonim say it's one thing. It's the same idea, that because something is dedicated to a mitzvah, so to use it for anything else would be a disrespect to the mitzvah. So that's, again, the third couplet. That might be one or two reasons, whether you understand those as two different ideas or you understand it as one joint idea. And then if it's a Huktzel Mitzvah, so Bizui Mitzvah idea, so we find this by other mitzvahs such as Sukkah, and then you have to figure out in some ways it's more Chomer than Sukkah, in some ways it's more Kal. So for example, it seems to be more Chomer because the usage that we're talking about, let's say in terms of counting money, or probably whatever kind of usage you'd be dealing with, is not the kind of usage that's so obviously us or another context, because you're not taking it away from its place, you're not moving it, you're not touching it. So to stand near the light and see from it, it's not clear that that's the kind of usage that would be us or in general when we talk about Huktzel Mitzvaso. So maybe there's a higher standard when it comes to menorah, or maybe there isn't. Maybe the fact that it's a chiddush, there's a little back and forth about that. And also, when it comes to Sukkot, the assumption is that the Isser only applies during Sukkot. Chanukah, we'll see, we'll discuss in a second, is a little more of a complicated question. So the Rishonim deal with that, and they basically suggest that Sukkot, when it comes to, let's say, the wood that you use for a sukkah, so your intent is that it should be for the sukkah during Sukkot, but you know the Sukkot is eventually going to end, and the walls, the wood will still exist, probably, so then you can take down the wood and use it for something else, because it was always a part of your intent that it's going to be a sukkah during Sukkot, but after Sukkot, not necessarily. But when it comes to the oil for Chanukah, we'll discuss in a second what's actually said about it, maybe it's more chomer because maybe one doesn't really expect to have anything left over afterwards, so therefore the intent is that it should all be dedicated for the usage of Hanukkah, and that intent may create a huksla mitzvah so that it has a wider scope. So it basically is a machlokas in terms of using the oil after the fact. There basically are three shitas, and again, it's a question how to read some of them. But some of the Rishonim, like the Ritva and the Ramban, say that after your oil has been going for half an hour already, after it's gone past the shear, then you're allowed to extinguish it. And that has led some to say, okay, you see that it's not muktzah past the time of the mitzvah itself, although I have to see if that's exactly comparable. But there is a more chamer view that's quoted from various places, which maintains that if you have anything left over after the first night, you have to keep it for the next day, and you have to use it only in that context. And then if the end of Hanukkah comes and you still have left over, then you have to burn whatever is left. So this seems to assume that there's an Isser even after the fact, after Yantif is over, it's still going to be Usser to use the oil. Who is it who says that view? It's a good question. It's in the Shil district of Achaigon, so some quote it from there. Some of the Rishonim quoted from Miktsas HaGaonim, that it's a minority view among the Gaonim, but it seems to have some earlier lineage as well, because, for example, Tosfos elsewhere quotes that same phrase and uses the word Titania, as if it's like a Mishnah or something. And it seems to also be a Medrash. It appears in the Medrash Tanchuma, so it comes up in a couple of different places with different levels of authority, or it's related to, you know, the Rishon who just quoted from the Shiltas, or from Miktsas HaGaon, and they don't seem to relate to it as a Chazal kind of source, but it has a crops up in a couple of different places. And we mentioned also at the time that Medrash is cited by Rav Yosef Engel, that Rav Yosef Engel has a position that when you have a Din D'Rabbanan, that Din D'Rabbanan has the effect of creating a Chavtza Shel Isser, that an item that's prohibited mid'Rabbanan has a status that's inherent to the item. And other Rishonim, other Achronim, because Engel lived less than 100 years ago, Achronim in general had assumed otherwise. They had assumed that the concept of a Chefza Shel Isser, of something being inherently bad, that's only true when you have an Isser Daraisa. So the Torah was written by God. God created the world, so God can say Chazer is bad, you can't eat it, and it's a Chefza Shel Isser. But if you have a chicken cheeseburger, you have something which is asa midrabanan. So many assume that Chazal have authority over us to tell us what to do. But they can't affect objects. They can't create a status on an object and create a Chefza Shel Isser. So if Yosef Engel disagreed, he said that they do have that power because God endorses whatever they say. God signs on to whatever they have declared, so it's as if it was written in the Torah as far as that type of impact. So he proves it, or he brings support for it based on the Medrash, that the Medrash has this line that we just said, that you have to burn whatever oil is left over. And then it goes on to say, and by the way, don't think you don't have to listen to the rabbis. You do have to listen to the rabbis. Everything that they say is considered to be law. So he says, why all of a sudden here in this Medrash we get a Musar Shmuz about listening to Dinam D'Rabbanan? There's so many places to talk about that. Why Davka here? So he explains that one might have thought, like all the other Achronim think, that an Isser D'Rabbanan cannot affect an object, cannot create an Isser Chavtza. So if that's true, you wouldn't have a concept like Chutzal Mitzvah. So you wouldn't say that an item is dedicated to a mitzvah if it's a mitzvah D'Rabbanan, and that would give it a status of prohibited usage. So the fact that we do have that halacha, apparently, that comes to show you that there is a status that attaches even to Yisurim D'Rabbanan or Mitzvahs D'Rabbanan, and that's what the Medrash is emphasizing here by connecting those two statements. So he cites that as proof for his general position about this issue. So in any event, it's a little bit of a shaila how this plays out. Shulchan Aruch quotes both dinim. Shulchan Aruch quotes the din that you can extinguish the candles after a half an hour. And he also quotes the din that whatever is left over has to be burnt. So it seems a little bit like it's a contradiction the way that first opinion was understood by the other Rishonim. So there are various approaches. Maybe it only means that anything that's from the first half hour's worth of oil can't be used for anything else. But if you had oil that would have lasted more than half an hour, then that's not included in the mitzvah. It's a little bit hard to be mitzamtzem. Others assume that maybe it all goes to your intent, that if you have intent to extinguish it, to use it for something else after the time is over, so then you have the right to have that in mind because it all flows from your original tonight. But if the idea is that you put it in stam, so then it becomes all dedicated for that purpose. And that's why the Mishnah Berurah recommends that one who puts oil into the candles, oils into the holders, should have intent that he's only being makdish, so to speak, the amount of oil that's necessary for this purpose. Hi.
Is there no need to have any negative kavanah when you purchase the oil?
The purchasing doesn't seem to be the... I mean, you could make a case that purchasing is done for that purpose, that it's all hektish.
Dafke, the chanuk oil, like the chanuk seal and wrapper on it.
Right, it's true. They made it for that purpose, so it's an interesting question if that makes it hektish. So it's dafke, that's an interesting discussion. I wonder if anyone talks about that. And it also reminded me that you could make the same chiluk by sukkahs also, that if we assume that the walls of a sukkah, you can use them afterwards because they're not, you don't expect them to be there forever. You know the sukkah is going to end and you can have the walls afterwards. But what if you have a prefab sukkah, so you bought pieces that are made for the purposes of sukkah only, and then the rest of the year they get put away in the box until next year. So maybe that is also a different kind of context. So you're right, the earlier postgame are not dealing with these pre-packaged Hanukkah packages. It's an interesting question how to relate to that. It's probably, probably does make a difference. And presumably that is also the case. You don't find people using the oil from those packages for their cooking. You know, it's not like they want to use it for anything else. The oil that's in these packages are only for that. So that's the question about what about whatever's left over? Do they dafka burn it for the next year? So that's a good question. I think Mishnah Berurah also points out that really, maker adin, you should be able to save it for the next year. If you can carry it from one night to the next, you should be able to save it for the next year's usage. But we don't trust people to be able to keep it around their house 51 weeks a year without 51 weeks till the next Hanukkah without, or in this case, more, right? Between now and leap year. So we don't trust people to be able to hold on to it for that long, so we say whatever's left over, it has to be burnt. But theoretically, as long as it's not used for anything else, and maybe in the packages it wouldn't be used for anything else, and maybe, Taka, that's how we do relate to those packages. Hi.
I don't want to get on topic, but with the practices, so what if one has something that is dedicated for the use of the sukkah, but it wasn't like dedicated when it was made, meaning that...
But it could become dedicated later.
Yeah, like meaning you bought canvas to for the walls.
Yeah, that's the usual scenario. That's right. The usual scenario is that it's not dedicated when it was made. What Jonathan is introducing is that it's a chiddush of the modern era that you go to stores and there are items like this that are made for sukkahs and for Hanukkah candles. But in the classical discussions, they weren't made for that purpose. So it's only your choosing to use it at this point. And then it's a whole shaila when it becomes, probably only becomes when you first use it for the mitzvah. And we're shown and discuss when that's true and when that's not true. But let's assume for now that it only becomes usur once you've used it once for the mitzvah. But so then you are dedicating at that point is going to have significance.
So I can't use those canvases for something else.
Oh, well, if you just bought it and you never used it, you might be able to.
Sorry?
If you just bought it and you never used it, you might be able to.
Oh, yeah, okay. Okay, but after you use it for
right. But if you have to use it for sukkahs, so then that's what the Rishonim say after sukkahs is over, you should also be able to use it. It's only during sukkahs, not also while you're bringing the point to sukkah. So also just to kind of highlight the chumrah between sukkahs and Hanukkah, is that when it comes to sukkahs, so there is a question the Onigyantif raises. It says, why is it that we're allowed to sit in the sukkah in the rain? The Gemara says that if it's raining, that you're a hedgehog if you don't go inside. You're a putter and you're not obligated to stay. But maybe we should say that it's not just you're a putter and you're a hedgehog, but that it's also to sit in the sukkah, because if you're not allowed to benefit personally from the sukkah outside of the mitzvah, so if it's raining, there's no mitzvah, and you're protected a little bit by the sukkah in the rain, so you're benefiting from the sukkah, not in the context of the mitzvah. So he asks that question. He also asks, how could it be that we let women sit in the sukkah if they're not chayiv in the mitzvah? So they're benefiting from the sukkah without a mitzvah. So the approach most take to this question is that's not called benefiting, that the kind of benefit we're usually worried about is when, if you want to take the wall down and use it as a chalkboard, something like that, you're going to negate its purpose as a mitzvah item. That's the kind of usage that's a problem. So to sit in the sukkah, not 100% as a mitzvah, but the sukkah is still fine in the way it's supposed to be, so presumably that's not really such an issue. Which is why, again, it's a chiddush in the context of Hanukkah that something like reading by the candles is going to be an issue, because it's not so obvious that that's the kind of huxla mitzvah so usage that would be usher in other contexts. I mentioned also that Reb Shlomo Kluger suggests that really this concept of huxla mitzvah maybe should only be by kedusha things, by things that are holy, and holy is usually defined by something that has, let's say, kitzvei kodesh on it or something like that. And it's not clear that it should extend to mitzvah items that are not kedusha by definition. So he suggests that maybe there are basically these three exceptions, that menorah, because of this comparison that some of the Rishonim have to the Beis HaMikdash menorah, so therefore it's called Kodesh, even though it doesn't necessarily follow the rules of Kedusha elsewhere. And also Sukkah, the Gemara says in Daf Tes in Sukkah, that Chal Shem Shamayim ala Sukkah, the Sukkah has a Shem Shamayim Kedusha status to it, which is its own fascinating topic to discuss, because it's kind of a paradox. We're supposed to live in it like it's our house. We're supposed to treat it as Kedusha. It's not a 100% harmonious concept. But also, then there's the Gzeir Shava, that this is true also by Lulav and Esrog. So maybe these three exceptions, that really should only be by things that are Kedusha, but Hanukkah, Menorah, and Lulav, and Sukkah are all exceptions. They also have the status, maybe. Rav Osner doesn't like this totally. He points out, he emphasizes a couple places in his writings that the menorah idea is not, the menorah space HaMikdash idea is not the view of all the Rishonim, it's only the Balamor and the extreme, and maybe a few others, so we still have to account for other opinions. That's a discussion in and of itself. There's also, I'll just mention one or two other points, and then we'll break, but there is also a discussion that you could ask, do these reasons affect whether the Isser is on only the household members or is it on anyone? Like if it's Kodesh, then presumably anyone is Usser to use it. But if it's about you don't want to be Mavatal, your mitzvah identification, so presumably that's only an Isser on the people who are connected to it in that way, the household members. And it wouldn't necessarily be Usser for some outsider to use a light, because why should he have the responsibility of not being Mavatal the mitzvah status of somebody else's candles? There's discussion about this in the Sefer Yerach HaVoadim, and he notes that if you want to pay a lot of attention to Haneros Halalo, we said you can now give a whole shiur in the words of Haneros Halalo during a Hanukkah candle. So we use the language Ve'ein Ulanu Rishus L'Hishtamesh Ba'am, which could be read as saying that we, the ones who light it, we don't have Rishus, but others maybe do. Is that significant? Who knows? A lot of words that one could be mafalpo in the text of the Haneros Halalo, we have a whole new understanding of what's going on there. We also took this opportunity, we'll just mention this point, to mention the chumrah, the alleged chumrah of the Avnei Nezer, that once we're talking about something being huxla mitzvah, so we have to figure out what is the mitzvah item here. So is the menorah itself a mitzvah item? Which would also have the implication that you need to have a menorah, let's say, as opposed to, for example, let's say it's the first night of Hanukkah, so it's relatively simple. So to just take a candle, go to the windowsill here, burn the bottom of the candle and put it in the windowsill, so maybe that's enough. And there are stories of great gedolim doing that. So the Avnei Nezer is quoted as saying that that's not going to work because you need to have a kli, that there is a halacha of a menorah, and that's also part of the mitzvah function here, and therefore lighting without a menorah is not going to work. So the reason I'm phrasing it like he's quoted as saying, or he's alleged to say, is because it's true, he does say those words, but by the end of the tshuva, he's not 100% committed to that position. He basically raises the question in his tshuva, and he goes through different possibilities, and he brings proofs for both sides. He brings proof that there's no significance to the menorah, and he brings proof that there is significance to the menorah. He doesn't really clearly conclude one way or another. In the middle of the tshuva, he does say those words that it would come out that according to this position, one who just lights a candle without a menorah would not be doing what he needs to do. But it's not clear that he signs on to that lahalacha. So again, to say that this is a kapeda after the fact would be hard to say. It's at best, you know, suffik derabanan, the suffik and a din derabanan, and other achronim don't really have this idea so much. Rav Osner has a piece arguing on it, and even the Avinezer, it's not clear that he signs on to a likuva. So it's very hard to say to anyone that at the end of the day, you're not yotzei without a menorah. But it's a discussion to be had, and it has other implications as well. For example, the question of hiddur mitzvah, that we'll have to chaz that topic head on, but if we assume that hiddur mitzvah is a notion that mitzvah items should be beautiful, so then the question could be asked, so the menorahs are often very expensive, high-end items, so is that technical hiddur mitzvah that you're actually taking a separate from the mahadran or mahadran sugya? But whether or not mahadran and a mahadran is the standard hiddur, you could still ask the question, does the standard hiddur apply in different ways to the menorah? So we have an idea, for example, of using olive oil, using candles that will light nice, strong flames. So what about the menorah itself? You want to have a beautiful gold menorah, so is that a standard hiddur mitzvah? So it would seem to relate to the question of whether the menorah itself actually is a chefta shel mitzvah, even if not a chefta shel kedusha, but just let's say a chefta shel mitzvah. So that seems to be the question the Avinezer is raising. Is there a significance independently to the menorah as a mitzvah object, or is it just the candles? So that's a little bit of an open question as well. All right, so we'll add that mincha, and we have a lot of other things to talk about, so we'll continue our chazara.